Before we start today's episode, there's something important for agencies seeking a reliable way to attract new business, especially during busy periods. I want to introduce you to Leadflow Sprint. It's an eight-week program that simplifies your marketing and consistently attracts the attention of potential clients without requiring a massive marketing budget or external sales teams. With my 17 years of experience in aiding agencies to gain visibility and new clients, this program offers a practical and effective approach to lead generation. Forget about unpredictable leads and embrace a method that works across different agency sizes. And if you're keen to learn more, you need to visit caffeine.club/LFS. That's caffeen.club/L for Lima, F for Foxtrot, S for Sierra. Now let's get into today's episode.
And, you know, sometimes you have to join the dots for them. And I think that's where the marketing of the event kind of takes over and has to work in tandem with the programming, because you can get a good person to tell a good story on stage or on Zoom, but it's the marketing and promotion of the event that joins the dots for people.
You're listening to Caffeine Espresso, a podcast series that delves into the way we grow design businesses. I'm Charlotte Maldari, founder at Caffeine, a new business and marketing company for agency world. And every other week, I'll be interviewing a guest, taking your questions, or delving deep into a topic that clients struggle with, and generally try to make growing your agency feel more achievable and less like a job that keeps getting pushed off the to-do list. It's an excuse for me to pick the brains of some of the people I most admire and address topics that pique my interest, like how not to feel yucky in the sales role, what do clients want from their new agency, and how not to spend half your studio resources each month on new business. This is a podcast that combines the little things and the big things, because as you know, managing an agency is made up of both.
Mark, thank you so much for joining me on the Caffeine Podcast. I am so thrilled that we're getting to restart this conversation after a few years of interruption. I worked with Mark, or first kind of came in contact with Mark, when I was at Brand Opus and in charge of raising the profile of the agency. And one of the important things for us was to be at the right events. And at the time, Mark was very much one of the senior people in charge of putting together the agenda for Cannes Lions, just a small festival that you may have heard of. So I couldn't think of anybody better to talk to about events in the marketing space. Thank you, Mark, for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So can you tell us a little bit about your journey in the world of events and up to where you are now?
Sure. Okay. So I ended up in events from journalism. I started work in journalism in a sort of nightclub and music and alcohol space, which was a kind of weird set to be sort of doing concurrently. And I moved from there into PR, and both of those things kind of indirectly led me to doing event marketing for clients. And that led to Cannes Lions. Actually, no, it didn't, sorry. That led to Festival of Media, where I was editing one of their creative media products, which was like a database of innovative work, which was called Cream, which I think is defunct now. But Festival of Media is still going. That was their live version, and I used to program speakers for that. And then from Festival of Media, I went to Cannes Lions, where I programmed some of the stages there. I also programmed their European touring festival called Eurobest, which I think we worked on as well.
Yeah, we did.
And then an event out in the Middle East called Dubai Links, which both Eurobest and Dubai Links were like essentially smaller regional versions of Cannes, if you like. So I was at Cannes quite a long time, and then I left there and went to News Corp, where I was global communications director for their ad tech arm, Unruly. And then I went freelance last year. And now I do event consulting and program consulting. I'm doing a lot of work with a publishing outfit called Tortoise, which is a slower, wiser news platform. And they have an event that they call a think-in, which is sort of like a live discussion event, and they run about 15 think-ins a week, and I program those. And Tortoise will have anybody from Tony Blair to George the Poet to Sir Terry Leahy from Tesco. It's all sorts of politicians, creatives, commentators, scientists, business people, and that's really exciting.
An incredibly ambitious and exciting project. After we made contact a few months ago during the depths of lockdown, and you mentioned where you were, I was talking to my best friend about Tortoise, and she's now a member, and she goes regularly to the think-ins. And we were talking about you the other day, and she was like, I just can't get over the agenda, like the quality of the people, the access, the ability to be able to raise your points and questions, and the frequency and yep, the caliber of these talks. So you've got one mega fan within my fold, so congratulations.
I mean, I can't take credit for the format that they developed, but that they have this think-in format, which is based on the sort of the news editor conferences that happen in newsrooms, or at least used to happen in newsrooms. It's about creating this forum for civilized listening. So it's not about bear pit debates, which I'll admit is something that I had to get used to, because previously the received wisdom was, when we were at Cannes, you need a debate, you need to have opposing views, and there's got to be sparks and fire on stage. And to a certain extent, there is some truth in that. That gives you, it gives you a bit of a thrill. You know, if you're looking for a dopamine hit in a session, two people arguing on stage will give you that. But if you really want to kind of move something forward, that kind of sort of tabloid style telly doesn't get you anywhere. An episode of Jeremy Kyle doesn't resolve any of those problems. It just lets you kind of get a cheap thrill off the problems that you're seeing on screen. And so with the Tortoise thinking, at the end of it, everyone comes away better informed, in a position to kind of decide where they sit on a particular topic. And the format actually enables you to tackle some really difficult, sensitive issues. Things I've programmed recently, there was one about, should we be ashamed of Winston Churchill? I mean, that was spicy. We've covered things like sort of trans rights issues, slavery and reparations. I mean, but you can still do it. You can cover these emotional subjects and not have to kind of resort to sort of histrionics and sort of cheap tricks like that to make the content successful. So I'm loving it. And I had to learn a lot when I came here, because it was very different to programming stage content. But I think it's fantastic, and hopefully I shall see you some more.
Yes. Yeah. No, I hope to join some more. Absolutely. And in the meantime, friend Sophie is reporting back to me and thoroughly enjoying it. Thank you for what you're contributing. The format that you're currently working on in terms of think-ins is really interesting, because previously you've been working very much on physical events, certainly during the time we worked together, in collaboration, and obviously those have come a cropper of COVID. How do you think this industry will innovate? Do you think Tortoise is kind of leading the way in that, and what do you think about our industry events as in
marketing? Sure. Events? So I think Tortoise, like all events, flipped pretty quickly to digital. And I mean, it's kind of a special case, I guess, in that it had a strong online presence anyway. I mean, that's where the written content sits, really strong podcast offering. So it was just a natural step for them to kind of flip the live event thinkings into an online version. And there wasn't a huge amount that needed to be done to the format. It was just the delivery mechanism. So taking it out of a room and putting it onto Zoom.
Yeah.
In terms of other events, and particularly marketing industry events, from what I've seen, that they've all tried to change, and that's great. Some more successful than others. Some, I noticed, have been given a new lease of life, I think, by switching to digital. I guess the danger in the event space is that in the absence of events, lots of people who would normally have gone to them, either as exhibitors or speakers, you know, people like you in your old role, who were using the event to kind of benefit from the platform.
Yeah.
In the absence of that live platform, lots of people have now set up their own thing. So an example for that would be someone like Salesforce, right? So Salesforce, you would have seen them at things like Cannes, maybe South by Southwest, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Salesforce over this summer have been running these online interviews with really high profile people. And I was gently taking the mickey out of it because I think they had like pop stars and then it was like talking about some serious subject. So it wasn't this, but it was stuff like Chrissy Hynde talking about market segmentation. And there were some unusual pairings, but fair play to them. I mean, they've got the money to hire that talent. And I saw it a lot, right? And I think that's the thing that older established events now have to contend with. Their competitor set has grown. It's grown exponentially because lots of people are doing it themselves.
Yeah.
Because you can do now.
Anyone with a camera and a mic, basically.
Everyone with a camera and a mic. And also a lot of the barriers, like if you wanted to put on an event and you wanted to interview Chrissy Hynde, you know, before there was a load of stuff that came with that. You know, yes, you know, you had to get through agents and managers and bookers and all of that kind of thing. And then you had the logistics of, you know, well, there was a money side, there was an appearance fee, which invariably would involve travel and accommodation and a rider and everything else. Now it's just a case of, does she have half an hour free to join the call? And that's one of the things that we benefited here enormously from. Yeah. We never would have, I don't think, got Tony Blair, or at least it would have been a while before we got Tony Blair. But being able to do it digitally kind of opens up this new range of people, not only locally, but also internationally.
Right? Yeah. So in that sense, would-be speakers from smaller agencies, thinking specifically about my area, are... they're both empowered, but also there's a competitive aspect there because
yeah, definitely. I mean, but at the same second, you know, the potential reach, right, is far greater than it ever was. And I guess it, but yeah, there is greater competition for people's time, not just in terms of how many events they go to, but also just the fact, you know, screen time. We spend all day looking at our screens now, and people get screen fatigue. I mean, you can effectively be on a Zoom call pretty much, you know, from first thing in the morning till last thing at night, and then, you know, go and watch telly because we're not allowed to go out at the moment. Yeah. So I think it's thinking really smartly if it's something you're looking to do. If you're a smaller creative shop that is sort of thinking of maybe staging your own event or something like that, it's being really kind of intelligent about what it is and when it is and why people should come to it, because there is just so much demand on people's eyes now, in a way that there wasn't, right? Because before you would buy, I mean, you got your ticket to, let's say, Cannes, and you kind of decided what you would do. Well, I mean, not you, because you would plan it properly like we always talked about, but lots of people would buy their ticket to Cannes, rock up and be like, right, I'm here now. What stage shall I go to? And that's pretty much the same for most conferences. You buy your ticket because you like the sound of some of the people, you turn up at the venue, and then you would sort of just roll from session to session. That's not possible anymore. And that kind of serendipitous discovery of content isn't really possible. Zoom-based things like this, you know, by definition, are appointment-based events. And you've got to find that time in people's diary. And that's not easy.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree. Your role is to curate content that appeals to multiple demographics and needs at the same time. How do you manage to get that balance?
The way that I normally approach it is just always thinking about the accessibility of it, right? Because I think if you get a bit too into the weeds of the different demographics and sort of needs of the audience, like, it's something you need to consider, absolutely. But you can't let that sort of dominate your thinking. Obviously, you need to have a clear sense of who a particular event or program is for. But then it becomes about making the ideas you want to talk about or the stories you want to tell accessible. And you know, I mean, here, for instance, we cover some quite niche things. I'm working on a thing at the moment about the future of cities, and that's looking at things like transportation and housing. And, you know, if we'd never put on a thinking saying, you know, come to this thinking about housing. I mean, that doesn't sound very exciting. Some people who work in housing might be like, oh, okay, that's for me. I'll come along to that. And this, you know, the same principle applies in sort of marketing events. But if you've got like a hook or an angle, it's about making sure that people can see a way in to that story. And you know, sometimes you have to join the dots for them. And I think that's where the marketing of the event kind of takes over and has to work in tandem with the programming, because you can get a good person to tell a good story on stage or on Zoom, but it's the marketing and promotion of the event that joins the dots for people. Because it's like, oh, okay, if we talk about marketing events, you know, and you get a creative director wanting to talk about, I don't know, some idea they have, which is backed up by loads of case study work. I don't know, sort of creativity on a shoestring, right? That was always a pop topic. You get someone that wants to talk about creativity on a budget. Okay, so for young creatives, the sell for that story is different than if you were trying to get brand side people to come on. It's the same thing when they turn up, but effectively the door they walk through into that room might have a different sign on it. And I think that's, especially now, you know, you've got digital events with a larger reach. That's, I think, where probably people need to do a little bit more work. You know, we have the capability to do it. You'll know as a marketer that you can take the same thing and sell it different ways and pitch it to different people. And that doesn't always happen in events. It's something tortoise experiment, you know, it does it quite well. It doesn't do it on an industrial scale, but we do specific outreach to various groups who we know would be interested in a thinking. And they have a thing here called the Tortoise Network, which I won't go into and bore you with, but it basically allows them to tap into different community and expert groups who might be interested in a story. And for marketing events, I think there is a tendency to kind of rely on like, oh, we've got this creative director, he's going to talk about this interesting thing, and that's it. They sort of feel like that should be enough. And it's not.
Because, and I was just thinking of a couple of things as you were talking. One of the things I loved about the events that you put on at Lions, Eurobest, got involved in Spikes, Links, and Cannes itself, was the sense of there's always an overriding theme for the event, which is introduced to you as a potential speaker from the get-go. And, you know, even if there's a loose kind of thread that attaches each talk to that, there's a general theme, and that will apply to a much bigger range of people who might be attending that event. But equally, I've written content for events in the past where it hasn't been clear who the audience is. And you're absolutely right, it's really hard. Yes, the talk might be the same regardless of which side of the fence that person in the audience is on, client side or agency side or production side. But it would be really handy to have more of an understanding of who those people are going to be in advance so that you can angle the way you market it to your audience, and support that event organizer as well, because that's their role, I guess, to market the event, get bums on seats, get people there and paying for it, or in this case, opening the screen to Zoom.
Exactly. And I think, you know, sometimes a lot of the mistakes that people walk into is making assumptions about what different people will get out of a session. So just assuming that young creatives are only interested in X, or just assuming that brand marketers are only interested in Y, it's a little bit more kind of complicated than that. And the only way that you kind of get that insight is from having a chat to a couple of people. I mean, I'm always talking about the thinkings or the stuff I do outside of Tortoise. I'm always talking about it to people. Hopefully not in a boring way. I'm just thinking,
How could
no,
it be boring?
I
Fascinating, diverse
don't
range of topics.
God, here comes Mark again. He's going to bang on about another conference he's talking about. But no, I think, and so I socialize it. I socialize what I'm working on and the ideas that I'm working on. And you very quickly get a sense and of what these different kind of routes into a story could be. And you're never, it's always different to what you think it's going to be as well. So when a new thing lands on my desk, either at Tortoise or from a private client, I always have some initial thoughts like, oh, great, okay, so this is for these kind of people. This lot are going to be interested in it. This is going to appeal to women over 60 and mums and all this. And then very quickly, you find that that's often not the case. So it's, you always need to talk about these things with people who are outside of your bubble. And I'm always tagging things onto phone calls I'm having with people or lunches and coffees. And you do need to kind of, yeah, I guess you need to socialize it.
Absolutely.
Hello. Yes, it's me again. I'm sponsoring my own podcast because, well, I can. And I'm going to take a good guess that you're tuning in because you want to grow your design agency to the next level. So I just wanted to let you know about the Caffeine free 5-day mini course. In this fantastic and, did I mention it, free training, you'll get an email a day for 5 days jam-packed full of simple strategies that'll give you the courage and confidence to grow your design business. Just go to caffeine.club, that's KAFFEN.club, and hit get started to get access. Thanks for listening.
So a bit of a move on from that, do you think contributors should focus on building content around trends or perennial topics? Is there just thinking about what topics to pick?
So I guess there's two parts to that. So the first one is if you were a client of mine wearing sort of like my comms hat, I would say that it's important that you carve like a niche for yourself and a topic that you can own, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to be the agency that is known for having some great ideas about creativity on a budget, or I don't know, specializing in a particular field, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if carve out a niche for yourself in that space, that's great, but then you have to kind of have a program within that, right? Because you can't be, if you're talking about creativity on a shoestring, you can't just always be banging on about like things that didn't cost very much money. You have to talk about like all the different facets of that story. So I think it's important that agencies identify, or you know, creative shops identify an area that they want to play in and then specialize in that. Because producers and editors, they will then get to know you as someone reliable, so that it's not always you saying, I'd like to come and talk about this thing. Sometimes you'll get editors who are programming stuff and they'll be like, oh, I need someone who can talk about creativity on a budget. Ah, I know, I'll give Charlotte a ring. She's bound to have somebody at her place. So I think it's important that you kind of find a groove, and specialize in that groove. Now, in terms of then specifically sort of topics and trends, again, I sort of, you find a groove in your area of speciality, and then you bring trends to life within that
lens.
So it's the people, like when I was at Cannes, it would be the agencies who would kind of be just like, yeah, we can find someone to talk about that, yeah, we can find someone to talk about creativity in the Middle East, yeah, we can find someone to talk about, you know, creative processes. They'd be like, okay, I need to know that you've got someone there who really cares about this particular story, who will die in a ditch for this particular opinion, rather than just, and I get it, because, you know, particularly at some of the larger agencies, the PR team, they're probably working under KPIs. We want to speak at 4 events this year. And it becomes a little bit like, okay, let's just get someone on stage. For the record, that is the worst kind of strategy. You shouldn't be looking at speaking on stage. And I think actually we had this conversation about 6 years ago. You shouldn't ever consider the moment where your person steps out on stage to be like the end point. That's not the objective. That is part of the strategy. Getting someone on stage is not the end goal in this. And if that's your approach going in, I'm not saying that you won't be successful in terms of getting people on stage, but what you won't crack is making that opportunity work.
Yeah,
nothing will happen as a result of it, because you get the slot, you get your person on stage, everyone's like, huge sigh of relief, right, what's next? And then where's the follow-up? How do you leverage that opportunity? Because it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money, time, and just sort of energy, tears, anger.
Yeah.
To make that moment happen. And if that's the end in itself, you're really not making the most of it, and you're probably not thinking about events in the right way.
Absolutely. And I think that's so important, rather than hitting the numbers in terms of how many events you're trying to reach, is picking them very carefully, understanding why you're doing it and how it builds into a bigger strategy. And plus, how are you going to recycle that content as well? Because my gosh, the number of hours I spent laboring over a deck that's going to take 20 minutes on stage. I mean, literally weeks. And then that's it. Like, what if it just sits on the server forevermore? That's just absolutely frightening to me.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, then the producer sends you the video, and then that goes on that goes into the graveyard intranet.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. Even worse. Yeah.
So, and I think that's another common mistake, is that people don't see the live events. They don't see it as sort of part of a strategy. It's kind of, sometimes it's seen as just like an add-on, like, wouldn't it be great? And other times there is no strategy. It's just, I would like to speak on stage at this thing. What I've noticed is during my time at Cannes is the people who folded it in to a bigger thing. Like I loved, you know, the stuff you used to do, where I remember you used to tie it in with the client experience and doing the whole, like, okay, we'll bring some clients to this third party event so that they can see our people on stage being brilliant and saying really smart and clever things. But then also I'm going to make sure they see some other smart and clever stuff that complements the thing that we're bringing them to see. Yeah. And that, to me, that was genius. That was like, yes, that's how you do it. But that's how you do it, right? That's how you, because lots of people at Cannes just spend a fortune giving their clients passes. And the client goes, oh, great, I've got a ticket to Cannes. Never see them during the 5 days, because they're all off in the hotel bars or up and down the Croisette at the various parties. So you've just kind of blown a couple of grand to give a gift to the client, which you haven't really made the most of it. Like, yes, I'm sure they're grateful for a while, but you've missed out on a huge opportunity there. So yeah, I guess at the risk of laboring the point, folding events in to your overall strategy and not seeing them as like the end goal in themselves, that's if you do that and nothing else, you're already going to have a much better time.
So thinking about that, and that kind of sense of who we're going to pick out the pool of spokespeople to throw on stage to meet our KPI of X number of events per year, what makes a good contributor? What makes a good speaker? Because not everybody's a natural speaker, but lots of people have stuff to say even if they're not a natural speaker. Yeah. Often makes me very sad when the person who's very PR friendly is thrown up on stage, even though they're not the most expert or the most passionate or willing to die in a ditch, in your words, about a particular topic. So what should we think of in a broader scale about who should be speaking on stage?
Sure. So I guess there are two bits to this. And the first bit is you have to have people who care about the thing that they're talking about. So, or if it's a bit more of a kind of a debate type format, someone who is prepared, as I said, to die in a ditch over that idea, someone who is personally invested in whatever it is they're going to be presenting on stage or on screen. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, okay, accepting that not everyone is a natural presenter, although it is a skill that can be taught, right? It is very possible to teach this, and it doesn't take very long. I do a nice kind of 2-hour like intensive course in how to basically feel comfortable on stage, and it's
interesting. I didn't know.
And it's like a really intensive thing, and it's the kind of thing that you would sort of probably panic by, like, shit, I'm speaking tomorrow, I'm really worried. Okay, we can fix that problem. Now, if it's something you're going to do a lot of, and you want to kind of take it to a higher level, then I would always recommend you get some proper speaker training, sustained, and also you maintain that training. So when I was at News Corp, we put a lot of people through some speaker training. I was fortunate because we were able to tap in to people that they had who worked in the business who trained the DJs for Virgin Radio. But nonetheless, it was a proper course. You went in, you did it, I think it was like half a day. But then every year the plan was that there would be a refresher, right?
Yeah.
Because that's important, because bad habits creep in and all sorts of stuff. And also it's just, you know, it helps with people's confidence. So if you accept that not everyone is a natural presenter, and you don't have time to kind of bash the emergency button and have me come in and fix it, the other thing you can look at is changing the format to fit the speaker. Right. So if you've got someone who isn't kind of a natural sort of orator, who can get up on stage and knows what they want to say, they've got the talking points in their head, they don't really need a script, they can speak to an allotted time, and you can rely on them to do it. I'm thinking now people like Rory Sutherland. Right. As a conference producer, he's a dream, because he basically asks you how long he's got and he'll just get on. And he'll just talk and it will be engaging because he's Rory Sutherland and he knows how to tell a good story. If you've got people like that, great. I think about 4 of them exist in the world. If you've got people who need more preparation, okay, that's fine. So how can we come up with a speech that doesn't sound like someone just stood behind a podium reading it out? How can we break that up? If we've got someone who is terrified at the idea of being on stage on their own, can we put them on stage in with someone else? Are they more comfortable if we get them interviewed, like in a I hate the term fireside chat. I sort of feel if it's a fireside chat there should be a fire on stage. Make most fireside chats more interesting in my opinion. But if you want to do the one-on-one interview, great. Who would be the best person to interview your expert to make them feel comfortable so that they can forget their nerves and just tell the amazing stories they've got to tell? If it's more of a panel situation, or if you need to kind of steal the thinking format from Tortoise, you know, it fit the format to the person. If they're the best person, you can always find a way to make them feel comfortable, or create a structure that they will share the stories you want them to share. It's a bit of work, but it's worth it. And I'd always, you go with the person first and then everything follows from that. If you put someone on stage who's going on and reading a deck that they didn't make, I know you used to build decks for other people, but you know, a deck that they're not invested
in. Oh, in very close collaboration, trust me. There's never left a way.
I've seen it again, some of the bigger agencies, the deck's been prepared sometimes by an office, you know, completely different to the one that the person's working in.
Yeah.
And they've seen it probably the day before, if we're lucky.
It's petrifying.
Yeah, and then they turn up on stage and then they've just looked at it and they're like, oh, can I make some changes? At which point, you know, you want to bash them over the head. If you've got those people who kind of haven't seen the deck, haven't really been invested in it, or they're reading someone else's words, it will always look like that. It will always look like they're not their words, because, well, they're not their words.
Yeah.
So find the person who really cares about the story and then build the format around them. If it's your event that you're putting on yourself, there is no reason why that can't happen. And if you're working with producers, like if it is a Cannes Lion or Adweek, Adweek will just give you the stage, but if it is a Cannes Lion type scenario where you've got their producers who are kind of really involved in the content development, they'll be happy to hear the ideas. If you've got a brilliant idea which will help get this amazing story across, they'll be totally open to it. They just want the best thing on stage that they can get, and they'll be open to your suggestions of, oh, actually, could we do this as a panel? Could we do it as a game show? Could we do it as a interactive experiment? They'll be really up for that. So yeah, not sort of being constrained by the whole, like, let's just get someone standing up with a PowerPoint, and if so-and-so is too scared to do it, we'll get someone else to present. You know, you don't, there's no need to think like that anymore.
And you raise a really good point then, using the producers. If there is an engaged production team who is actually interested in the content that's happening at the event, because that's not always the case. But one of the things I think is really underused, and one of the things that I think puts a lot of people off approaching for speaking opportunities, is this idea that you need to go with the finished product and that you can't tease an idea out together. I think the best talks that I've been a part of have been ones where we've gone with a vague concept to the event producers, maybe a couple of sentences and three bullet points, and then had a conversation with them and evolved it out from there. And then it's something we know is in line with their programming. We feel more confident about fleshing out that presentation, being on point for the audience, and they feel comfortable about giving us the stage and more likely to do that again in the future.
Exactly. I mean, I remember coming to your office, those really swanky offices just off Charlotte Street. I remember they were incredible. And you know, you showed me around and we had chats with various people. And I seem to remember, like, there was like a fake supermarket. Was there? You worked at an office with a fake supermarket?
I think there was at the time. Yeah, we were doing, shelf shots and a kind of internal way to see how packaging might fit amongst the competitors.
Yeah, that's right. So, that stuck with me. And I remember, and we had a chat about the sort of things you were working on, and just kicked some ideas around. So I remember going back to the office and saying, I've just been around this office and they had like a pretend supermarket. And I think we got chatting about it. And in the end, that led to, quite a few sessions I remember we worked on together. But yeah, I'm not saying that you need an office gimmick to kind of catch people's attention, but it was really helpful for us just to have a couple of non-committal chats about kind of the world that you operated in at the time, the sorts of expertise that you had in the business, and also the things that they kind of cared about, which might not necessarily have been like a core business thing at the time. Yeah. You know, I remember when you worked for Near. I mean, I remember he was a football fan. That's something that's kind of stuck with me. And I remember just the stories he would tell me about sort of various client meetings and stuff like that. They were fascinating, right? And he was a guy who had, still has, you know, like, he had strong opinions about stuff, and things got him angry and frustrated and grumpy about the industry. Now, that's never going to come across in a pitch that you fill in online or an email that you send to me, right? But I came away from those chats that we had thinking, okay, I've met this guy. He's a bit grumpy, but he'll be great on that. Grumpiness will translate really well on stage. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, back to producers looking for sparks and ways to keep people engaged. I absolutely do think your spokesperson, in my opinion, if they've got a personality and if they've got strong opinions and they're not afraid to share them, and that doesn't necessarily mean knocking other people's work, that can mean just, you know, really pushing a point.
Caring about something, actually, caring.
Because, as you know, back to your point about too many screens, too much content, everything. I just feel overloaded these days. And it's been something that's come on since I first got an iPhone back in 2010 or whenever it was. It's just got worse year on year. And I think that ability of a spokesperson to be able to really capture your attention and make you sit up and listen, even if you don't agree with them, it gives you food for thought. And in my opinion, that's what events should be about. It should be about this idea of, topping up your kind of creative resources. And too many agencies use it as a way to just go speak at something and hope, wish and pray that potential clients are in the audience and not spend time going to all the other stuff that's around and learning from it.
Exactly. And I think, you know, and that's the other, just go back to the earlier point, that is the whole reason where you need to think about why you're doing the event in the first place, right? Are you going because you want to show off a bit? It's not a bad reason to go, you know, that's fine. If you want to kind of blow your own trumpet, that's a perfectly valid reason to do it. Are you going because you're going with a strong kind of new business strategy? Are you going because you want to kind of do a bit of a thank you for clients, but make it educational at the same time because you're trying to get some ideas over the line with them and you think this is part of that strategy? That's great. The worst pitches that you get, or the worst briefs now that come in, is like, oh, you know, our CEO is really great. He would like to talk about this. Like, yeah, I don't think many people are in, people are not generally, on the balance, seniority isn't really a thing anymore. That's quite an old-fashioned way to look at it. You know, our MD would like to take part. Is your MD the best person? Or is one of the creative team the best person to tell this story? Or, you know, is it one of the more junior people that should be involved in this? There's always this kind of, there is still a little bit of a nagging mentality that the only people worth hearing are from the people at the top.
Yeah.
And I think particularly in the creative industry, particularly in marketing, that is not the case, right? Yeah, I can say it now. I don't work at Cannes anymore. I don't do much work with Unilever, but, you know, everyone would get very excited about Keith Weed being on stage, and Keith would, he'd be great. He was a fantastic speaker and he would say interesting stuff. Keith Weed isn't really involved in the day-to-day stuff of what's going on within the various Unilever brands. He's got a couple of case studies, but he's not at the coalface of it. And the same can be said for, like, at the very big creative shops, you know, the global creative directors and chief creative officers, they're very rarely kind of in the nuts and bolts of what's actually happening.
Yeah.
They just get to go to all the nice meetings and do all the travel and take a lot of the credit. And that's, you know, that's the way the agencies, the agency world is structured in some of the bigger players. And, you know, like, that's just part of the world we live in. But particularly, like, with the independent shops and the more kind of specialist outfits, there's no need. It doesn't always have to be the founder or the CEO, or at least only the founder or only the CEO. There's some really interesting people in your business and they're not always going to be in charge. And some people, some businesses have trouble letting go sometimes. Yeah. There's this kind of idea that it's only safe to put the CEO on stage. And having worked with lots of CEOs, I can tell you they're equally as likely to say something that will make most PR people kind of bang their head on the desk as anyone else. Right? If in many cases it's more frustrating because you've sat down for 2 hours saying, do not say this. And the first thing they do is go up on stage and say the thing you didn't want them to say, or crack the insensitive or poor taste joke that you've explained it, but a little bit sexist or a bit misogynistic, or, you know, or any other kind of ist. Please don't crack that joke. It's not funny, but they'll still do it. So there's rich kind of this sort of body of opinions and passion, sometimes even more passion when you go a little bit further into a business rather than just looking at the C-suite. I feel like I've made a bit of a campaign speech there. I'm sorry.
No, but I think that's fantastic. And actually, I think it doesn't just apply across events. It applies across many different facets of agency marketing and agency new business. And there's definitely a lesson to be learned there. I think it's happening slower in this industry than in others, particularly technology.
But I'm impressed by it. Clients like it. Clients like to see the people who make up this potential partner, right? Because, yeah. You know, they're not stupid. They know that, yes, they might meet the global account director or the senior account director who kind of gets the business in the door. They know that there's going to be a whole other group of people behind that person delivering the work and doing everything else. So they like to meet them. And, you know, from a marketer or PR perspective, it's an amazing way to kind of boost your employer brand, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the other reason, let's face it, when you're going to these industry events and 75% of the room is also basically people like you, you know, other agencies, other producers. And yes, there's that kind of much coveted brand audience, but they're always generally, they tend to be in the minority. It's normally other people, your peers. The other real reason to go to these events is to kind of advertise how great it would be to come and work for you. And mm-hmm. if you're equally amazing or more amazing than us, please come and work for us, right? That's the other benefit of doing these events. And putting people from within the business who aren't just at the top on stage is brilliant for that.
Yeah,
absolutely. Because people see opportunities then.
So aside from not just thinking about always shoving the CEO on stage, is there anything else you should avoid doing with industry events?
Yeah, so generally speaking, people, it's a habit to talk about the blindingly obvious. So, and also rehashing the same stories over and over again. So things like if you've got a case study that's really good, there is a shelf life to that case study, you know, in the length of time you can dine out on it. So you need to be constantly refreshing that supply of examples of work. There was nothing worse at like Cannes and Eurobest and stuff, where someone would come out on stage and be like, yeah, he's going to play that one. He's going to play that video. Oh yeah, that one again with the dogs. Oh yeah, that one again with like the crying old ladies at the end. Like it gets predictable. So you always need to make sure that you're staying away from being predictable. The other one is you don't have to demonstrate everything that you know in your allotted slot. So if you've got 20 minutes on that you know everything, and also say everything that your agency does, right? Because you can't, and it's really boring, and there's no way that that doesn't become a sales pitch. So pick a thing and stick to the thing. If you're a creative agency and or a design agency, and let's just say, I don't know, you do a talk about humor, right? Using humor in creativity. People are not going to think that just because you've gone on and talked about humor and creativity, that you can't do anything else, that you're only doing funny stuff, right? So pick a thing. That doesn't mean people will forever associate you with that topic. You might be about emotions and creativity. That might be like your groove that we talked about earlier. And that's great. So you might do anger and creativity, humor and creativity, I don't know, sadness and creativity. That would be quite a nice groove, actually. You can have that if anyone.
There you go, people.
Yeah, there's an idea there. But like, don't feel like you have to kind of, oh, actually, it'd be great if we showed that case study because we do cars. Oh, and we should show this one because we also do healthcare. Like, it's not a catalogue. And people understand that you're there just to talk about a thing. So hone in on a topic and do that really, really, really well. Because if you do it well and people like it, they'll get in touch with you regardless of what their brief is. They won't pre-screen. The audience won't like go, oh, they talked about funny stuff. I'm a healthcare client. They're not for me. They'll go, oh, those people were brilliant. That was amazing. I'd like to meet them. And then they'll get in touch. And
entertainment. It's not a sales pitch. And that's, you just got to always be thinking about that when you're building your content.
Exactly. And then also keep away from gimmicks. Because, I mean, whilst I'm saying fit the format to the speaker and come up with inventive things, yes. But the minute you get into sort of things that make the audience have to do quite a lot of work, like downloading apps, I mean, the number of times we would have it at Cannes and stuff, where it'd be like, oh, we want to do this session. And what we're going to do is we're going to ask people to download this app and then they have to do this thing. And it's like, no, just forget it. It's a waste of time and money doing all of that because you'll lose half the room. Half people's phone won't work. Half of them won't have their phone charged. The other half would have dropped their phone down the back of the seat and won't be able to get to it. The other half won't get on the Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi will crash. It'll just be a disaster. The room won't be with you. The speakers on stage then will be like nervous because no one's filled in the online survey.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It just... Yeah. Keep it simple, but that doesn't mean that it can't be innovative.
Mm.
I feel like there's about five things.
No, it's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, although a lot of the people listening to this won't necessarily have the money to build something like an app that engages the people in the audience or not, as the case may be, I think the point still is valid. Like, the gimmicks are so used at industry events, particularly on the lower end. And yeah, it's not engaging. You see so many people faffing around rather than actually listening, and that person uncomfortable on stage thinking about when is it time to start interrupting them from doing the activity. It's just a waste of time, and considering you spent so long trying to get that tiny slot of time. Just
exactly. And I think just to sort of finish that bit off, I would say if you can't come up with something that's an interesting story to tell, if the time's not right, then walk away from events for a bit, right?
Yeah.
I know smaller agencies that they would say, right, this year we're going to focus on awards, and we're not going to do speaking, we're not going to do a load of other things, we're just going to focus on getting some awards entries into a really good place and enter awards. And then the next year, they're like, right, we're not doing awards this year, we're going to look at speaking because we've got some interesting stuff to say. And then next year will be something else. So you don't have to do everything all the time. And if you've got nothing to say for a bit, that's fine. Not all businesses have stuff they need to kind of get out there. They don't have an opinion on anything. It's totally fine to take a year off of doing events. In some cases, it might even help you because you sort of arrive back on the scene 12 months later, a bit re-energized, you know, you're fresh meat in the eyes of the producers.
Yeah.
It hasn't been around so much. You know, I'm not saying shut off all your PR, but like, you know, you just do other things, give the speaking a rest for a bit if you're reaching for things to say or finding people to say them. Don't, and that comes back to the original point about the event is not an end in itself. And if you can't fulfill them, it's okay. There's no shame in saying, let's not do events for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I'm just going to, taking so much of your time up, we've now clocked just about an hour, and I just had one final question before we talk about you and how to get in touch. What is your favorite business book?
Yeah, so I thought about this, and true to form, I don't have a conventional answer. So I've mentioned him already, and I know that everyone's got the Rory Sutherland books, but the audio book of Alchemy is fantastic, right? And if you want to hear, it's great. And if you want to hear someone kind of, because most audio business books are absolutely flaming terrible. They are awful. But this one's really good. And he presents it, or he reads it like he presents on stage. So if you want to kind of hear a masterclass in Rory Sutherland speaking and being a kind of marketing and creativity raconteur, the Alchemy audiobook is really good. In terms of proper books,
sorry, Rory.
Sorry, Rory. Yeah, so I'm actually doing some stuff at the moment with Murky Books, which is Stormzy's publishing label. Wow. And this isn't a plug as such, because these are aimed at 18 to 25 year olds, but they're fantastic. There's a whole series of them, and they start coming out this month. And they're all like these how-to books. So there's the ones that I know about because I'm talking to people to come and do stuff, is How to Write It, How to Change It, and How to Build It. How to Build It, trivia fans, is co-written by a guy called Damola Taimian, who used to be at BBH and who spoke on stage for me at, I think, Eurobest in, I'm going to say Antwerp. And the How to Write It is by a guy called Anthony Anaxagoru, who's, it's basically how to write rap and poetry and just how to write. Basically.
Wow.
So there's a whole series of them. How to, they start coming out in October. How to Write It, I'm going to recommend, because that's the one that I've done the most work with. And yeah, that's my business book.
Well, look, maybe.
It's aimed at 18 to 25, but it's not just for 18 to 25.
Sounds exceptionally relevant to me as well. Get it on the older wish list. Amazing. And before we go, Mark, where can people find you, and who should get in touch with you?
So there are two sorts of people that should get in touch with me. If you're interested in Tortoise, either being a contributor or finding out more about Slower, Wiser News, they can get in touch with me at marksandandrew at tortoisemedia.com, or just go to tortoisemedia.com and all the information's there. If they're interested more in my other life, I run something called Brand Culture Therapy, which is a project where I'm working with a qualified therapist who's also a marketing director, and we go into businesses, sometimes quite small ones, startups as well, and help them understand kind of who they are, what they want to stand for, and how they can bring that to life. And then we create like toolkits that then could be used, I guess, for when you come in and do their marketing services, or they want to kind of build an employer culture. And that's brandculturetherapy.com.
Amazing. It's absolutely fascinating, because I think when we first started talking, you were just at the beginning of lockdown, you launched the company, and yeah. I was looking online and I couldn't find all that much, but I'm so excited to delve into a bit more of what you're doing.
So there is a website. We used lockdown to build a website, and we've had a couple of clients through the door. So we did a lot of work with the Masters of Wine, which is the global network of wine growers, and we helped them with their whole sort of 5-year strategy in terms of engagement with members and how they were going to present like what their aims and missions were to the rest of the world. And yeah, it's that kind of stuff. It's really interesting, and we bring therapy listening techniques to the process. So it's fascinating stuff. I'm learning lots of stuff about therapy, and John's teaching me. He's teaching me lots about therapy, and I'm teaching him lots of stuff about comms. So
fantastic! Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for all your time today and all your absolutely wonderful wisdom and some of those amazing ideas that can literally be lifted out of this podcast.
I'm all about sharing the love. It's fine.
Well, thank you again. It's been wonderful talking. All the best with Tortoise and Brand Culture Therapy.
Thank you.
Just before we wrap up, I want to touch on a crucial opportunity for your agency's growth. As a creative agency, your primary focus should be on delivering exceptional work, not getting bogged down in sales and marketing. And that's where Lead Flow Sprint comes in. It's an 8-week program designed to streamline your lead generation process, bringing in a steady flow of potential clients to you. No more struggling with the ups and downs of trying to gain the attention of new business. Our program includes hands-on support, including direct input on your copywriting, ensuring a bespoke approach to your lead generation needs. No more feeling stuck in the feast or famine cycle. Our real-time support, including direct feedback on tasks like copywriting, helps you to bid farewell to inconsistent leads and embrace a lead generation system that's tailored to your unique needs. Visit caffeine.club/LFS. That's caffeen.club/L for Lima, F for Foxtrot, S for Sierra.